content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Diane Edelman for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Reader's Digest. Our first article, Get Me to the Church on Time. Nothing would keep this dad from his daughter's wedding. Not power outages, not floods, not even one of the largest hurricanes on record. By Tom Hallman, Jr. David Jones sat glued to his television set as meteorologists gave updates on Hurricane Helene. The storm, packing 140-mile-per-hour winds, was expected to hit Florida late on Thursday, September 26, 2024, before moving inland toward four other southern states. One target was Boiling Springs, South Carolina. David, 65, and his second wife, Debbie Jones, had just moved there from Johnson City, Tennessee. Debbie's 84-year-old mother hadn't been doing well, so they bought a house in her hometown and moved the matriarch in with them. And now he sat, hoping he'd still have a house there come morning. But David had more on his mind than the storm. On Saturday, his oldest daughter, Elizabeth, 33, would be married in Johnson City. David, who by his own admission had a casual relationship with time, had been ordered to get to the church on time. So he and Debbie decided to make the two-hour drive to Johnson City on Friday. They'd spend the night in their old home, soon to be on the market. Then, on Saturday, at exactly 10 a.m., he'd be at the church to walk Elizabeth down the aisle. Then came Hurricane Helene. Powerful gusts rocked the Joneses' home on Friday, starting at 5 a.m. For 7 hours, David listened while rain pounded the roof and strong winds snapped tree branches. And then the skies cleared. Electricity and self-service were out. Other than that, though, no real damage. By 6 p.m., the power still had not been restored. Debbie, uneasy about leaving her mother in these conditions, said she'd stay with her and, sadly, miss the wedding. David understood. He packed his SUV, kissed his wife goodbye, and was soon on I-26, a four-lane rural interstate that would take him through North Carolina and Tennessee and into Johnson City. As he drove, listening to a satellite radio station featuring 70s mellow rock, his thoughts turned to the day Elizabeth was born. Thrilled to learn it was a girl, David had placed a red rose and a card reading Happy Birthday into her hospital bassinet. As he thought about his little girl, he couldn't help but wonder, "Have I been a good father? Does Elizabeth know she can always count on me?" Cars inched along as crews cleared toppled trees from the highway. By 10:30 p.m., 4.5 hours in, David had driven less than 40 miles. He wanted to pound the steering wheel, but told himself to be calm. David was a business performance consultant who gave seminars on tenacity, bravery, and determination in the face of extreme adversity. Now, trapped on the interstate with no cell service, he had to practice what he preached. "The wedding's tomorrow. I can't reach anyone and tell them I'm stuck and can't make it. Those are the facts," he told himself. "I have to find a way to get there." David forced himself to focus and think of Elizabeth. "I will be there because that's what Dad does." He formulated a plan. Figuring locals knew their way around this small town, he followed a group of cars off the ramp. The caravan wove around downed trees and over downed power lines. The plan seemed to be working, until the group came to a halt. A massive tree blocked the way. David broke off from the back. He turned around, wondering if he was pushing his luck driving over the downed power lines again. No choice. Noticing that cars were once again moving on the interstate, he drove up the on-ramp and continued out of North Carolina and into Tennessee, where he hit another roadblock and drove down another off-ramp. From decades of living in Tennessee, David recalled a two-lane country road somewhere nearby. He found it and made a loop, following back roads to another interstate on-ramp. After a few more miles on the interstate, he reached a road closed sign. At the bottom of the exit ramp, he saw state troopers talking and blocking the on-ramp on the other side of the road with their patrol cars. David parked his SUV on the shoulder and walked over. "Can we help you, sir?" "I'm trying to get to Johnson City." "You can't. The interstate's closed. We have bottled water. Want one?" "No. Can you just let me get on the interstate and drive around the down trees? I've been doing that all night." "We're not letting anybody on the interstate." "My daughter's getting married in Johnson City. I'm walking her down the aisle." "I'm sorry. The bridges are gone, washed out. Nobody can get through." "How about the back roads?" "Some of the roads have been washed out, too. The best thing you can do is go back to your car. Wait until the morning. Maybe the interstate will be open by then." David shook his head. "I have to walk my daughter down the aisle." David returned to his SUV to plot a new strategy. Back to Boiling Springs, over to Charlotte, up to Wytheville, Virginia, over to Bristol, Tennessee, down to Johnson City. Maybe a 7-hour drive. If all goes well, I might make it to the church on time. 2 miles down the road, he looked at the gas gauge. Nearly empty. He backtracked and found the troopers gone. In their place, a civilian in a car blocking the on-ramp. David learned that the man had volunteered to block the on-ramp to let authorities deal with the more pressing storm-related problems. David filled the man in on his situation. After a bit of thinking, the man said a nearby road led to Irwin, a small town 15 miles south of Johnson City. From there, he said, the interstate would be open all the way to Johnson City. "If I can get on that road, and if I can make it into Irwin, I could probably make it the rest of the way to Johnson City on foot if I had to," said David, thinking out loud. The man then dashed his hopes. "I've heard secondhand that 3 bridges have been washed out. I've heard 1 bridge is still standing, but officials aren't letting anyone cross it because it might be unstable." "It's worth a shot," thought David. Back in his SUV, he checked for cell service. Nothing. He tucked the phone in a pocket, then rooted around his rig. He didn't need the new wedding suit, shirt, tie, and pair of shoes. He had clothes in his house in Johnson City. Not new and stylish, but good enough. He shoved his shaving kit, socks, and underwear into his backpack. He locked the SUV and took stock of himself. He wore old running shoes, cargo shorts, a long-sleeve fishing shirt, a windbreaker, and a ball cap. Not exactly battle-ready, but it is what it is. It helped that he was in good physical shape, running 5 miles 2 or 3 times a week. He approached the volunteer, who rolled down the car window. "I'm heading out on foot." "Good luck." It was 2:15 a.m., so dark that David couldn't see more than a few feet in front of him. He pulled out his cell phone, battery 100% charged, and turned on the flashlight. He was stunned by what he saw. The road was covered with thick mud and broken tree branches. David guessed he was maybe 25 or so miles from his Johnson City house. He'd have to move cautiously. On the road, he found a pine branch stuck in the mud. It had sharp edges from where high winds had ripped away parts of its smaller branches. Concerned about anxious bears, nervous skunks, and nasty barnyard dogs on the loose, he snatched up the stick. "This is coming with me." And he walked. A patrol car suddenly passed, returned, and stopped. The driver shouted, "Are you sure you really want to be out here?" "My daughter's getting married in Johnson City. I'm walking her down the aisle." An officer in the passenger seat spoke up. "If you can get to the bottom of the hill and get to the interstate, you can make it to Johnson City." The interstate's closed to cars, so it should be clear for you. David walked on. With each step, the road grew more treacherous. Broken tree limbs poked out of muck that he sank into up to his ankles. If he fell, a sharp branch could impale him, leaving him bleeding and helpless in the dark. Sometime after 3 a.m., he saw the lights of a bulldozer and a backhoe clearing the road. He approached the dozer driver, who looked surprised. "The road's completely blocked," said the driver. "My daughter's getting married in Johnson City. I'm walking her down the aisle," said David. "Let me radio the other guy and see if I can get him to stop for a minute." When the backhoe shut down, David scurried past. Farther up the road, he was stopped by a wall of debris covering the road and spilling over the edges. He figured it was at least 7 feet tall, a tangled mass of mud-trapped trees, bushes, fencing, fence posts, and anything else that had happened by. He picked one side to walk around, careful to not stumble and twist an ankle or roll down a hill. It didn't work. Sucked into the mud, he lost his stick and fell into a sitting position. He tried to move, but couldn't. Behind him, maybe 50 feet away, the backhoe got back to the task at hand. A bright light on the end of the machine's arm cut through the black night like a beam on a lighthouse. "He can't see me," worried David. "He won't know I'm here until he hears a thunk when that arm hits me." Using all his strength, he slowly pulled his legs from the mud. In the process, he lost a shoe. He dug deep into the mud, found the shoe, and threw it over the pile of debris. The rumble of the backhoe grew louder as the beam of light drew closer. He spotted an opening in the pile that seemed just big enough for him to crawl into with the backpack. Inside, as he struggled through the dark, wet mud, the pile seemed alive, moving when he moved. He rolled over a tree, hugging the massive trunk like a koala. Using his arms as if swimming, he pulled his body deeper into the hole. 1 foot, 3 feet, 6 feet. The humid, fetid air suffocated him. 8 feet. As he fought through the muck and the backhoe ambled toward him, the mound shook and trembled, as if it might collapse and bury him alive. And then he felt a cool breeze coming from a small opening. He pushed, pulled, and kicked through the debris until he popped out and toppled end over end onto the road. He walked quickly, small, sharp rocks and debris cutting through the wet sock on his right foot until he found his shoe. He slipped it on and got out of there as fast as the sticky mud would allow, scrambling over two more piles along the way. Eventually, he found the interstate on-ramp the officers had told him about. No cars. Nothing. Just mud, downed trees, and a man on foot. He walked a few miles until he heard rushing water. He pointed his cell phone flashlight over the washed-out bridge and carefully peered into the abyss. More than 30 feet below him, David saw concrete and twisted metal. There was no way he was crossing to the other side from here. He checked his watch. 4 a.m. He had to be at the church at 10 a.m. He guessed he was 20 or so miles from his house in Johnson City. Once more, he forced himself to be logical. The volunteer had told him that one bridge was still standing, but officials refused to let anyone cross because it could be unstable. David looked around. Could there be another bridge around here, not on the interstate? Tired and hungry, he had to muster the physical, emotional, and mental strength for one last attempt. When his daughters were young, they nicknamed him the Camel. On long road trips, he never needed food or water and always ignored their pleas to stop so they could eat. Now the Camel trudged down an exit ramp. Should he turn left or right? David trusted his gut and went left. And there, a mile away, it stood. The Jackson Bridge over the Nillichucky River. Though two patrol cars blocked the on-ramp, he didn't see any troopers. This was his chance. He sprinted across. On the other side, headlights. A state patrol car pulled up alongside David. Are you the one who's trying to get to his daughter's wedding? How did you know? The trooper grinned. We're all talking about you. Want a ride? The trooper could take David as far as Irwin, 12 miles on. He dropped David off at the Irwin Town Hall at about 5 a.m. David was now just 15 or so miles from his old home. He started walking again. A few minutes later, a pickup pulled up, and the driver offered David a ride. 15 minutes after that, David stood in front of his house. He opened the front door and found everything as he and his wife had left it, some furniture, clothes, and a comfortable bed. David hadn't slept in more than 27 hours. He knew that if he lay on the bed or even sat in a chair, he'd pass out. Best to take a shower and get ready. He looked at himself in the mirror. He was caked in mud. His hair looked like a fright wig. He had cuts and bruises. He was a mess. A warm shower would have been welcome, but without power, he had to settle for ice cold. The shower woke him up. From his closet, he pulled an old suit, a shirt, a tie, and dress shoes. Outside, he fired up his old pickup truck that he used to haul things and hauled himself to the church. He found his two younger daughters and explained what had happened. Don't tell Elizabeth, he said. We'll have time afterward. Let this be her moment. Then he felt a tap on his shoulder. He turned around. It was Elizabeth, looking beautiful in her white wedding gown. David couldn't help it. He broke down. Elizabeth wrapped her father in her arms and squeezed. She then handed him a gift, a small diamond-shaped sticker for him to wear behind his tie. It was a photograph taken long ago at a father-daughter dance when Elizabeth was 9. She wanted her father to have this on his tie, close to his heart. David looked at the photo of the little girl, then at the woman standing in front of him. He was overwhelmed by the literal journey he'd just finished, as well as by the passage of time and the preciousness of life and love. His sister approached, looking puzzled. Bro, she said, what's in your ear? It looks like mud. David smiled. A keepsake from his journey. From inside the nave, the music began to swell. David took Elizabeth's arm, smiled proudly, and did what he'd set out to do 16 hours earlier. He walked her down the aisle. That was Get Me to the Church on Time by Tom Hallman, Jr. And now a second, shorter article. Join the Dull Men's Club. Finally, a meeting of the mundane minds. Just don't get too excited. By Kathy Free. Grover Click was sitting at a bar with three friends in New York City when it occurred to him that he and his pals were all pretty boring. The men belonged to an athletic club, and they were looking at a magazine that showed their contemporaries involved in activities such as fencing, judo, boxing, and wrestling. One of them blurted out, "Hey, we don't do any of these things. We're kind of dull," recalls Click, now 86. I had to agree. On that afternoon in 1988, the Dull Men's Club, or DMC, was born. I suggested that we needed a club for dull men, and we got it started as a joke, Click says. They came up with activities they could participate in, even if they did not have any particular athletic, artistic, or technical abilities. We'd race elevators at Macy's to see which one was fastest, and we'd have conversations about tire pressures, Click says. Soon, they had a room at the club where they'd meet. It had 17 chairs, enough for 17 members, he said. When someone in the group suggested that they invite women to join them, most of the members shot down the idea. They weren't as dull as we were, Click says, recalling the consensus of the group. Almost four decades later, much has changed. The Dull Men's Club is now a comfort zone for self-described dull men and women worldwide. more than 1.8 million DMC members post about their latest boring pursuits on the group's Facebook page and submit ideas for the Dull Men's Club website. On the group's Facebook page, it's rare to find much that's exciting or stimulating. Getting acquainted with a new oven, I noticed a discrepancy between the temperature selected on the dial and the temperature indication on an analog dial thermometer placed inside the oven, someone recently posted. Time for a proper investigation. Three club members chimed in with advice and opinions. Last night, while making calzones for my family, I came across the end shaving of a pepperoni, and I was absolutely delighted, a woman in her late 20s posted, getting 51 likes. I've been enjoying this wall for quite some time. Hope you like it too, wrote another member, posting a close-up video of his bland beige surroundings. He received 37 comments. Click loves it all, even the several copycat clubs that have popped up on social media. There are plenty of dull people to go around, he says. People post about their milk bottle collections, how they take out their trash, what kind of potholes they've observed, he says. I eat a chicken kebab about 4 or 5 times a week, and I like to take photos of those. It all works. Click said his proclivity toward dullness started when growing up in Chapel, Nebraska, a town with fewer than 1,000 people. Was I boring as a kid? Yes, I'd have to say that I was, he says, joking. I even had my mother put silencers on my rattles. His birth name was Leland Carlson, but Click decided that name wasn't dull enough after he started the Dull Men's Club, even though he was working at the time as a tax attorney and accountant. Actually, just tell people I was an accountant, he quips. Tax attorney sounds too exciting. I thought Grover Click had a nice dull ring to it, he says, adding that another benefit of the new name was that he wouldn't have to explain his club activities to his employer. Now retired, Click divides his time among Winchester, England, Washington, D.C., and his hometown of Chapel. Although he's been single his entire life, he says he has a girlfriend who puts up with his favorite pastime of sitting on park benches. Click says he is baffled but delighted at the success of the Dull Men's Club. He's put out several calendars featuring some of the group's members, from a California woman who is obsessed with wet floor signs to a New York City man who collects security envelopes. Barbara Hartsfield, a nurse from Atlanta, says she has taken gentle ribbings from friends and family members ever since she appeared in Click's 2022 calendar, but she considers her membership in the Dull Men's Club an honor. I actually don't consider myself dull. I prefer the term intriguing, said Hartsfield, who posts on social media about her collection of 3,000 miniature chairs accumulated over 30 years. It was an unexpected treat to end up in the calendar, she says. According to Click, there is no shortage of dull material to write about. But whoever thought that watching elevators at Macy's would lead to all of this, he muses. One of Click's fans, Wade Juranic, now helps monitor the posts people share on the Dull Men's Club Facebook page. He says he knew immediately that the group was for him when he stumbled upon it years ago. I thought, wow, these people are interesting, but dull, says Juranic, who lives in La Crosse, Wisconsin, and works as a security guard. I became fascinated with the posts from other countries like the Netherlands, where somebody posted about how their garbage pickup works, he says. Little by little, I realized I was one of them. Click concedes that some might find the pursuits of club members more fascinating or eccentric than dull. I guess it's a self-assessment thing, he says. If you're thinking you'd be a good member of the Dull Men's Club, then you're probably already a member. Want to know more? Here are answers to some of the club's most frequently asked questions. What is the Dull Men's Club? It's a place for dull men and women who like to be around dull men to feel comfortable, free from pressure to be in and trendy. We avoid glitz and glam. We enjoy safe excitement. What's safe excitement? Watching paint dry is a classic example, but there are others. Watching grass grow, watching ice melt, listening to corn grow, and watching wood warp. It's okay to be dull? Yes. A main purpose of the DMC is to assure members that it's okay to be dull. We delight in ordinary things, things that many people think are dull. Is the DMC a movement? No, we prefer to stay put. Is the DMC a 12-step program? We are a step program, but only two steps. One, we admit we are dull. Two, we're going to keep it that way. Are dull men the same as boring men? Yes and no. Boring men are dull men, but not all dull men are boring men. Boring men are dull men who don't know when to stop. They go on and on. Are dull men the same as grumpy old men? No. Grumpy old men continually complain. Dull men don't complain the way grumpy old men do. Do dull men have a favorite color? Yes, it's gray. Do dull men have a favorite flavor? Vanilla. What's a favorite book for a typical dull man? A dictionary. Words are nicely arranged in order in a dictionary. What are you called? We're dullsters, opposite of hipsters. What do dull men do best? Nap. How can you know whether you qualify for membership? If you've read as far as this, you qualify. That was Join the Dull Men's Club by Kathy Free. We have run out of time for today's episode. I'm Diane Edelman, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Reader's Digest is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.